Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com. Hi, friends. This is Scott, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today, I'm talking with Thomas Happ. He is the developer of Axiom Verge. People call it a Metroidvania application, but I think that that is, frankly, doesn't do it justice. I've enjoyed it so much, and I could even call it the spiritual successor to Metroid. It's done everything that Metroid did and so much more, and it's just been a joy to play. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you.
So the thing that seems to be what people talk about when they write articles about Axiom Verge is that you started it as a side hobby. You just decided you were a game developer during the day and you wrote this at night?
That's correct.
Is that kind of a oversimplification? I assume it's much more complicated than that.
No, that's pretty much what it was. Just a hobby project that I did at nighttime while I worked on other things during the day.
Did you think it would take as many years as it would? I mean, you were a game dev during the day, so I assume you know what you were biting off.
I thought it would take as long as it did, or even longer.
Really? So you had no concerns about it being something you could bang out in a year or two?
No, I definitely didn't think it would take a year or two just because of experience in these things, you know. Even if I had had a team, probably a year or two would be close to optimistic. So I figured on my own, it would take many years. Wow. 5 was the number that I thought of, but I wouldn't have been surprised if it had been longer.
Oh, wow. Do you think that people who aren't game devs, like I'm a dev, but not a game dev, don't really understand how much thought goes into games, even simple games? Certainly Axiom Verge is not a simple game.
There's probably some where you overestimate and some where you underestimate. I know the general populace, like the non-developer at all populace, they definitely think games are easier to make than they are. But, you know, I've not been a normal non-developer, game developer to really understand, that perspective. I would imagine it's kind of, you know, similar to a software project, just that there's that creative element that kind of stymies all of your efforts to make an effective schedule because it requires iteration and doing things not according to plan.
Right. Now, you were a programmer during the day, but you were the programmer, the artist, the designer, the composer, the level designer on Axiom Verge. Did you know that you had those skills that, like, make music and draw the art?
I did. You know, it was something that was a hobby for me, you know, each of those separate things for many years. I knew I could write music. I was an artist. I'd actually been an artist on other games before mm-hmm. I was an engineer. Mm-hmm. I'd even made my own little games before, so I knew I had the capacity to do it. Sort of the question was, did I have the resilience to keep on with it for as long as it would take to finish.
That does make you wonder how many other Axiom Verges are out there inside someone's head or 40% done and have been stuck there. It really somehow is about the stick-to-itiveness and the deciding that on this random Tuesday night, I'm going to work on my side project because I believe in it.
I think that's very correct. I think a lot of it is that we're not built to think on the time scales of 5 years. You know, we're built to think on time scales of like a few months, that sort of thing. And you don't know to trust that, hey, if I just keep on working on this, it will be finished. And to try to stay focused on what you're just going to be doing in the next couple of weeks and not be overwhelmed by the fact that there are multiple years after those couple of weeks.
Yeah. I also wonder if, because you had worked on teams where people could do things in parallel, but with Axiom Verge, for the large part of it was just you're all by yourself, for lack of a better word, the serialization of things, the fact that there's one person with two hands that can only do so many things at a time. Did you compartmentalize and say, all right, this summer I will work only on music, or did you context switch?
That's very much actually what I did, was, you know, try to avoid as much context switching as possible. You know, even as an engineer, you realize, you know, every time your boss comes to you with, you know, an interruption or a task switch, or even just to tell you some work, you know, unrelated to work gossip, how long it takes for you to stop working and then start again. So a lot of my methodology was based around batching everything so that I never had to get out of the mindset of doing one thing and into the other, and that I always knew, okay, I've been doing, you know, this thing for the past couple of weeks, and I'm still going to be doing it tomorrow without having to get off that task and start back up again afterwards.
Mm-hmm. What was task number one? Was it opening something and saying file new project, or was it a napkin or a piece of paper?
Task number one was definitely making the overall game world map. Maybe that's because of the type of game. You know, Metroidvania is like a semi-open world with a very labyrinthine design to it. But the map also tells you how much you need to do in terms of, like, duration, and how many you need to make in terms of individual parts and individual items and individual tasks. So that was where I began with. So I had something to just get a grasp of, you know, the very broad strokes of what I would need to do later on. So I began with that, and not even knowing what specifically what abilities and items and features were going to be in the game, I had that map, and I had like a numerical list of, like, okay, this will be when you get item 1, item 2, item 3, key points. And I looked at other games, you know, I looked at Super Metroid a lot, not to look at the you know, the small scope of, like, what the features, you know, how the jump worked or anything like that, but more to get an idea of, like, the pacing, how many things needed to be in the first area, how many things in the second, for it to feel like it was a fleshed out world and not, you know, empty corridors, you know, so to speak, and to have it be something that when it was done, I could expect, hey, the player will probably take about 10 hours or so to finish this.
Mm-hmm. Are you okay with that description? Are you, like, I don't want someone to think that this is a derivative game. It is, like, you can go and say, oh, it's Metroidvania, because that fits in a tweet. But it becomes, as someone who's played Metroid many times, it becomes something else, and you realize that maybe inspired by would be a better way to phrase it.
I'm more or less okay with Metroidvania, maybe partially because even before making Axiom Verge, I was a fan, so to speak, of Jeremy Parrish, not the inventor, but certainly one of the popularizers of the term Metroidvania. It succinctly described to me what I was going for. It encompasses that range between Symphony of the Night and Super Metroid that are both pretty different. But if you know, like, once you go past those ranges and get into the Mega Man, it's no longer the same thing. So I'm okay with that. I think the difference is that the word means different things to different people, and to a lot of people, it means Metroid clone. And I don't know if the solution is to find another word, or if the solution is to use Metroidvania until it means, you know, something different than just Metroid clone to people.
Yeah. Well, maybe in 5 or 10 years, someone else will come out with a game and someone will call it, you know, an Axiom Verge clone. Because if you think about, like, Mario, Someone of a certain age might say, well, it's just Pitfall, you know, except with better scrolling and a funnier character, you know.
Yeah,
someone
it's decides very much to run. Reminds me of, you know, when every first-person shooter was called a Doom clone, and at some point people got tired of calling them Doom clones, even though to this day they are sort of like there's a gun in the bottom center of the screen and the primary activity in the game is shooting things at the center of the screen.
Yep, which is a really good way, I'm sure, to upset the Destiny 2 team, who I'm sure put a non-trivial amount of work into their game, which is ultimately just a Doom clone, which we certainly won't say to insult them. One of the things that struck me, because I was playing this game having read the narratives that you did it all by yourself, and I think, for lack of a better way of phrasing it, that knowing that you did it yourself and it wasn't a team of, you know, 20 people made the experience better for me as a developer, because I felt like I was playing almost against you. Have you ever played those games where you're like, you're in a puzzle in the game, and then you go and you put yourself in the head of the programmer rather than in the head of the game? Maybe it ruins the fourth wall of the game, but you were there playing with me and against me.
I was there. We must not, you know, rule out telepathy, you know, and other, you know, extrasensory perceptions.
That's gonna, you're creepy. I was there is now my ringtone. There was a time, I can't remember the name of the level, but you'll know what I'm talking about, where I'm, you know, maybe a couple of hours into the game and I jump off to the right, and then I wanted to return to the previous 1 to 3 areas, and there was an impossible jump. And I probably tried to make that jump back to the left for an hour. I was pretty frustrated with you because I assumed that it was a glitch. I could not understand. I needed to go back over there. And then when I finally came to grips with the fact that you did that on purpose, and, you know, it wasn't a physics glitch, then I realized that going to the right was my only option, and ultimately it was my fault. And then I became so impressed with the idea that it was always planned that way. How trying to get my head around how you think about those things, and what happens if someone glitches you and makes it back into the left there?
They can actually glitch me and make it back to the left. It's there's a way to do that. I know the part of which you speak, and I think in many ways what makes that feel, makes you feel like at first I did something wrong and then that you did something wrong, is that it's not apparent when you make that jump that you can't go back. If this were another game, that might have been something obvious, like, you know, there is a cave-in, or there is a bottomless pit that you know that when you're jumping in, you're not going back. But I made that jump just high enough, you cannot go back. And I think that is what's the difference there, and that's why it throws so many people. But there are ways to circumvent that, and the game does do its best to account for that contingency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was an emotional roller coaster, because you're just going about your business and you are not thinking to yourself, I better prep before I make that jump that I will never come back from. I don't know if I got the stuff I needed. I don't know if I'm prepared to make this jump. I don't know if I'm physically or emotionally prepared. It really got me thinking at that moment in the game. It went from being a Metroid clone to being an epic battle of wills against me, the average mediocre gamer, and I'm quite mediocre, and you, the genius level designer, because I realized that it was, wait a second, this thing was designed with a capital D, which made me wonder how much time you spent doing that level design. And it sounds like, as you said, it was step one.
It really was, you know, I guess it's a very programmery way to think of things, but the way I thought of that was to initially design that, hey, there's an obstruction that once you get past it, you can't return. I even made a notation of that on my map with like a one-way arrow saying you can't go back, without even knowing what I was going to put there. So it feels more organic when you see the final design that it happened to be a jump. But as I said, I could have gone, you know, a number of different ways. I could have made there be a cave in or, you know, a monster that you can't get past that chases you from behind.
Sure.
You know, any number of things. So
those things seem so obvious, though. The cave in is such a cliche.
Yeah, you know? And you spend a lot of time when you're developing trying not to do the same cliched thing over and over again. I don't know if it seems like a cliche to you, but I'm always trying. I always find myself finding pits. The character falls into a pit and he can't get out of it until he finds the item that's in the pit. And I keep on thinking, is there another way I could do this than putting the pit? But I think I put the pit that you can't get out of like at least 3 times in that game. And it just seems to keep coming back.
Yeah.
I see it in other games too. The pit you can't get out of.
The different flavors of obstacles you put in front of us, though, were like creatures that we are initially in like fear of, like, I can't kill this thing. This is horrible. I'm going to freak out every time I see that, to the, oh, now that I have this tool, I figured out how to deal with that creature. And that's not a huge deal. Or the even more annoying, like, how can I get up there? I think it was the number one experience that I've had playing this game, which is there's cool stuff up there. I don't see any way I'm going to get up there. Oh, I have a grappling hook. Now I can get up there, you know, but even then it took me about an hour and a half to figure out how to use the grappling hook to go laterally. Like it wasn't initially obvious to do that. I could go up and then I'm hanging there and I'm like, now what do I do? And then I could go, oh, I can go to the side. And, the sense of just enough frustration to keep me from dropping the game entirely, which I think must be a thing that you do, right? Like, I'm sure you'd be sad if everyone got 40% through and then just said, oh, forget this. They got frustrated and they stopped.
I think a lot of people actually get frustrated, you know, in the first area. They get past the first boss or they get up to him and they just kind of give up then. I would say is if people are going to quit, that's when they quit, is in the first area.
Oh, and then everyone who makes it past that is in it for the long haul?
Right, yeah. And I know this, you know, this is more like when I'm at conventions, you know, I'm sort of only seeing the people that are gamers and will have played every game they own to completion or not played them at all because they're in the backlog. But when I talk to my friends and family, it always seems to be like they got up to the first boss, they got up to the second boss, and then they stopped.
Hmm.
And they always say something like, can you make the next game easier?
But I assume that you didn't make the game for them. Do you feel bad about that? Do you have telemetry that phones home into some mobile app back end that tells you?
I don't have telemetry or anything like that. I have friends who have that, and I may ask to borrow that code. Just, you know, so I can get a better handle on things. And oh, my God, I can't tell you too much, but you know, the Chasm team, I'm friends with them, and they literally have a graph with spikes showing where people like die the most and or have spend the most time on combat, and they use this graph that's like basically, if you could imagine, the 0 on the left half of the graph is the start of the first level and 100 is like the end of the last level and all these spikes in between, and they use it to try and get it to be the cadence that they want it to be at. And, but I'm more like, I just try to generally get it to feel good and, watch people play at conventions or wherever I can, you know, get feedback.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense that there's some percentage, like it's a sales funnel, right? They've bought the game, but now they're in the game. Do 3% of people win and make it to the end? You know,
I don't know. You know how you could find would be to hop on to, say, Steam and look at the trophies. They usually have a percentage, and Sony PlayStation has the same thing.
That's interesting that you say that, because there has been a new kind of achievements on Xbox called Rare Achievements. And you'll find yourself going and saying, oh, wow, 4% of people got this. And that's a small number. Here we go. I'm looking at the Axiom Verge global gameplay stats, and it looks like 77% of people make it past the first boss, and it just goes all the way down to the end. 0.7% speed run it, 0.8% complete it in under 4 hours, and 3% of people make it through in hard. That is pretty, I guess, trophies as telemetry works pretty well, doesn't it?
It does, and you know, when you consider like just how this is kind of hidden from the consumer, but especially for consoles, doing any kind of networking is always just this, to me, it's this like headache fiasco, because you have to set up everything on the back end. It isn't like you just make your server and it does what it does. It's more like you have to register different things with the, you know, with the Sony or Nintendo or Microsoft, and set up things on their end so they know about your server and it's
right.
authenticated with them somehow. And trophies and achievements are one of the easier things, because even though they are networked, they want you to use them, so they make that barrier the easiest for you to pass. Mm-hmm. So me not having to do extra work like that is always a bonus.
That makes sense. So that brings up an interesting question from a development perspective. When you sat down and you wrote this, what is it written in?
C sharp.
So it's written in C sharp, so it uses Unity?
No, it uses a thing called Monogame.
Monogame, okay. And Monogame gives you quite a bit of reach. Monogame lets you, you know, as an open source project and uses Mono in the runtime, lets you basically go anywhere. You could, how do you like ultimately take that last percent and say, all right, I've written a Monogame, I'm going to compile it, runs on Windows. Now I want it to go on PS Vita or Switch or whatever.
So it's an interesting, long, convoluted tale, because I'd written Axiom Verge for XNA, for the Xbox 360. But, you know, around the time that I was, trying to shop the game around, that was when the Xbox One came out and the PlayStation 4 came out, and Microsoft sort of disavowed, XNA, and they wouldn't support it. But Sony had worked out a deal with, the Mono game developers, as well as the Mono develop owners, I guess, Xamarin. I think they're now owned by Microsoft, but at the time they were separate, and came together with a solution to port XNA games for the PlayStation 4, and that's how I ended up using Mono. And or Mono game. And it's interesting because Mono game right now like supports many platforms, but at the beginning, only like PlayStation 4 was the only console that it supported, and I was one of the very first to ever use it in that capacity, and it kept on going like that. Like Axiom Verge, I believe, was the first Mono game to be on Vita, and for that solution, you know, just for Axiom Verge, the Mono game team made a special cross compiler that would cross compile from C sharp to C++ for Vita. And then the same thing happened for the Xbox One when it came to Vita, or to Xbox One. Axiom Verge was the first, or one of the first, to use Monogame on Xbox One. And then the Switch, it was the first or one of the first to, come out there using Monogame. And at each step, Tom Spillman and his team at Sickhead Games basically had to make another port. You know, they ported Axiom Verge, but they also had to port their libraries, Monogame, to each of these consoles. And now it's very versatile, and it's something you can say, yeah, this is definitely good. It's one of the few that works on everything, you know, Unity being the other, and C++ by itself being, of course, usable on everything.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like in the process of developing Axiom Verge and pushing Monogame to the, you know, you basically broke the door open for other people who are now able to use it on Switch and all these other things.
I think it wasn't just that it was me. It was also the knowledge that, like, hey, you know, there's Axiom Verge, and then there's all these other developers that started off with XNA and this mm-hmm. system. You know, Stardew Valley helped a lot with that too. I think that they were sort of the genesis of the Switch push, because I remember, I can probably say this now, like way back a year ago, even, I think Tom like was saying to me, like, yeah, we have to port to Switch because of Stardew Valley. And I don't know what went into that, but I know that, you know, once you have so many people using the engine, it's just like you need to get it just for the sake of profitability of your marketplace.
Right.
So that was how that happened. And I think the genesis of that probably goes back to Sony taking that risk and saying, like, hey, we want to bet on indies and this is how we're going to do it.
Yeah. It seems like this is like there's a renaissance in gaming right now, and the indies, like, after a couple of false starts, are actually starting to get the respect and the reach that they deserve. And we, as the gamers, and as someone, I'm a huge fan of the Switch. Like, the Switch
is awesome.
It's fantastic. And I just didn't even imagine it was going to get as fantastic as it did so quickly. But I remember when we first bought it, we're like, oh, there's only 5 games. And now there is a huge library. And I would say 60-70% of it is indie games.
Yeah, it's definitely been a race too, because I think even before the Switch came out, if you were an indie developer, you were like, this is going to be the thing for me. You know, AAA developers, I don't know what they were thinking, but I know all my indie friends were like, yeah, this like portable giant screen Vita, basically, you know, that also works on a TV, is what I want to be on. And I think there was even, like a large degree of so many people trying to get in so quickly that it actually slowed things down. Like, you know, the chip production, I recall they were having issues like actually getting the factory to produce them fast enough, and you know, for the ROMs, and then like getting everyone, you know, approved. And like whenever we go through the QA process, it seems to take, I feel like it's been taking a lot longer than for other platforms. And I think it's just because there's so many big games like coming through, you know, Stardew and Sonic and whatever, like, are all like, yeah, we've got to get it out before Black Friday.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's definitely the thing. And November is going to be the time that all these awesome games, you know, Mario, but, in addition, like so many indie games will be out by then, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you have had a fantastic experience with Monogame in general. Like, you have no complaints. And do you think that is, if you want the widest release for a game, like, that is a framework you can bet on?
I think so. Probably the one for the widest release at this point is Unity. I mean, if you're not going to do C++, I think for an indie, I think C++ isn't as worth it. Unity would probably be the one I would do if I was like starting from scratch. But when you think back to like 2009, when I started coding, yeah, actually Unity was not the same thing that it is now. So it wasn't an option for me.
Right. But in both instances, you're using C# and .NET. So when you're writing Axiom Verge, are you thinking about memory management? Are you thinking, oh, I'm not going to be able to do this, a Switch doesn't have enough power, or I'll never be able to port it to whatever because of memory?
I do to a degree, you know. I had a friend, you know, also a game developer, and he said the way to think about C# for games is to pretend that it's C++. Allocate everything you need, like at the time you need it, like allocate all your particles and everything in a big batch in advance, and then have a manager that doles out the already allocated memory in your game. And then release it at the end of the stage kind of thing. Because it does come up. You definitely don't want there to be garbage collection in the middle of a stage of a game. You know, while you're shooting monsters, you don't want your bullets to accumulate gradually and just that one bullet pushes it over and all of a sudden the game pauses for, you know, a few frames while it's garbage collecting, and the player is going to blame that for why they died and probably be right.
Yeah, that makes sense. I see. So that moment where you switch to the next stage or the next cutscene, that fade to black, that's your perfect time to garbage collect.
Yeah, and you need to be more and more careful of that. You know, the garbage collection that comes that you get on, say, the PC version of C# is much better than the garbage collection that comes with Xamarin Monogame for instance. So once you start porting to consoles, that garbage collection hits you longer and harder than before, so you become much more aware of it. And for Vita was definitely the biggest challenge of all of them because it had the least memory. And Tom Spillman, the person who did that port for me, ended up doing a lot of optimizations to how I stored level data, how I stored this and that. And then I ended up making changes to the PC version and then, you know, helping him to merge my new code over just so that I think I rewrote the whole projectile engine just to do that thing where everything is allocated in advance in memory and I just dole out, say, the index to the next thing as opposed to actually using something that the garbage collector would see.
When you say something like rewrote the whole projectile engine, I think to myself, well, how do I know as a gamer, or do you ever have to think about as the developer, like it behaves differently on Wii U than it does on PlayStation 4, or the gameplay or the physics or the jumping or whatever is X number of pixels different because of, you know, you're standing on top of this framework and you're counting on this language and this runtime to do stuff for you. How complete is the layer of abstraction that you sit on, and how reliable is it that that Axiom Verge has the same feel and the same vibe on every platform?
I'd say, you know, due to the miracle of object-oriented programming, that it's very hidden from the player. You know, you have your physics object, your projectile class, and it is the black box that always behaves the same way. Regardless of how we had to change the implementation underneath. So, you know, even though, for example, the Wii U version was actually done by a different porting company, completely converted to C++, but it looks identical to the Switch version that was done by a different person with different coding language. I think you just, as long as you're careful and you did, you know, you encapsulated everything properly, you should be okay. Higher level game concepts tend not to be. The things that are affected are where the physical hardware of the system, how many buttons it has, whether it needs a touch screen, whether it has a secondary screen, those are the things that really change and can, you know, throw a wrench in your gears.
So you've been working on this since 2009, 2010, and now here we are 7 years later. You're on PlayStation 4, Windows, Mac, Linux, Vita, Wii U, Xbox One, and my favorite port, the ultimate port, is Nintendo Switch. What's next? Are you going to just spend time with the family, and or is there an Axiom Verge 2 coming someday?
Yeah, there's an Axiom Verge. There's another game coming in the pipeline. I'm not sure I can say what it is. Dan Aylman is always threatening to kill me if I talk too much about it. But I'm working on the other game. You know, I can never stop. I don't know how much your listeners would have followed the history, but my son is disabled and his livelihood depends on me somehow being able to come up with the millions of dollars that will be needed for him to live to a ripe old age of 90 long after I'm gone. So, I can never really stop working. Which is, you know, it isn't a bad thing. I would go insane if I did that anyway.
Yeah. Well, people can check out Axiom Verge at axiomverge.com. You can buy it on the Humble Bundle. You can buy it on Steam. It is everywhere that games are created. And I think that I cannot recommend this game enough. It is a joy. And I wish you all the best in future success, sir.
Oh, thank you.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.